Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill. A new podcast series from Newstalk.
Hello and welcome to a very special bonus episode of Show Me the Science with me, Professor Luke O'Neill. Now, tomorrow morning, you'll get your usual weekly show, but today we have a very special treat for you. I was delighted to get the chance recently to talk to Professor Adrian Hill. Now, Adrian is director of the Jenner Institute at Oxford University, and he's led their work on the now world-famous Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. Now, I started off asking Adrian how a Dublin lad became the principal investigator on the most important vaccine campaign in history.
Let me go back to the 1970s. So I was a medical student at Trinity, and I wanted to do what you call an intercalated year, where you can do a science degree in a year after your preclinical medicine. And I could have done that at Trinity. It was just a lot of physiology, and I was interested in things like neuroscience and genetics. So I had this crazy idea that I'd write to the professor at Oxford and say, could he let me go for a year? And amazingly, they said yes.
Right.
So the plan was to go to Oxford for a year, and 40 years later, I'm kind of still here.
You're still there, exactly. And you followed Oscar Wilde's footsteps, then, didn't you? Because you went to Magdalen, isn't that right? And Oscar went from Trinity.
I was, but I didn't know it at the time. But that's absolutely true. He did finish his degree at Trinity. I didn't quite.
Yeah. Ah, very good. Yes, and no regrets, obviously, because it's all gone extremely well, hasn't it?
It's got really interesting. I mean, the great thing about Oxford is it's a very large place, and if you want to do something that used to be a very small area, like vaccines, it's now exploded, of course, you get a bit more critical mass in the bigger universities. That's the thing.
Indeed you do, exactly. And when did you first hear of COVID? Give us that story as well, Adrian, because obviously we're all being asked this question. Can you remember when it first came across your desk?
Yeah, I do. And it was amazing because, you know, back in January, I was incredibly busy and traveling a lot. And I'd been to West Africa once, Uganda the same month. And then we had a meeting in Dakar in February. And, I was doing an awful lot of other things and aware of what Sarah Gilbert and people were doing. But, you know, to be honest, none of us knew this thing was going global in January. Even though there was a lot of work on making a vaccine candidate, it didn't really dawn on us till early February that this could affect everyone.
Yep.
And terribly. And, the rest is history. But by the end of February, everyone was working on it. So it changed very quickly from January to February.
And you obviously had a huge interest in vaccines going back many years, and you were using technologies that you'd tried previously, right? So in other words, it wasn't...
Well, this is the great thing. The technology we used, we started working on back in 2004, got it into the clinic in 2007 for malaria, which is my main vaccine interest. And then, you know, the big turning point was 2014 for Ebola, when the world realized that there were all these other outbreak pathogens out there, viruses, you know, like MERS that nobody'd heard of, that were serious public health threats. And nobody was making vaccines for them. So we started then.
Right.
And, you know, we now have a pretty large program overall on various outbreak pathogens that are horrible things for big pharma to work on because, happily they may never, ever appear as a big outbreak. But if you spend hundreds of millions of pounds making vaccines for them, that's bad news if you're a company.
Yeah.
So these are the obvious things for academics like ourselves to focus on, because, you know, we can take risk with government money and charities' monies and so on.
Right.
And that's what we've been doing. So we were reasonably well prepared for something like COVID.
Right. Before we dig into COVID, Maureen, I mean, my memory of you is your heart was being broken many, many years because the effort of malaria, as you remember, you got the Irish Society for Immunology medal one year, do you remember? And you came and gave a talk. And I'm thinking, how does he keep going? Because failure after failure, right? I mean, looking back on that phase of the whole thing, how did you keep through? I mean, it was tricky, wasn't it? And now there is progress with malaria, I imagine, but it's a tough game, isn't it? So in other words,
it's only been 111 years.
Yeah.
And it sometimes feels like I've been living through all of them. Malaria is very tough. There's been one phase 3 trial, nothing licensed, But, you know, in the next few weeks, we're going to start the second phase three trial. So we're excited about that. We had a big kickoff meeting just this morning. So we're excited. The initial results look terrific. So, yeah, it's been a long road, but, you know, we knew it was going to be. And again, this is exactly what the university researchers should be doing, something that, you know, if it doesn't work the first, second or third time, you'll still be there and you can have another crack at it as we learn more and the technologies improve.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, would you be optimistic, Aidan, now? I mean, obviously, given the success of COVID with the vaccine and so on, other pathogens may well fall to our sword eventually, do you think, because of the...
I think two things will happen. There'll be a lot more investment in vaccines because people can see how important they are. But secondly, a huge range of new technologies have come along, obviously the RNA vaccines and so on, that are there and available now, and there'll be more interest in, and combinations of RNA and viral vectors, which have come to the fore as well, could be very promising for really tough diseases like HIV, we've no vaccine, TB, malaria, and so on. Right. So yeah, the prospects are good.
Were you surprised it went so well? That's given the history and given the difficulties over the years with other pathogens, obviously. Were you surprised? Because it did go extremely well, didn't it?
It went extremely well. But, you know, every time you start a vaccine development program, you take a calculated risk. And we thought that this would be relatively straightforward. And so it's turned out to be. You know, if you'd said to me a year ago, you'll have 7 or 8 licensed vaccines by February 2021, I would have said, no, you won't. Yeah. You'd be happy to have one. So, yeah, it's gone better than we thought. But, you know, we wouldn't have done this if we thought, you know, the chance was 1 in 100 of it being useful, spending huge amounts of other people's money. So, in retrospect, COVID was fairly straightforward compared to other really difficult things that we take on, like malaria.
But how did it feel, Adrian? Now, here you had a vaccine going into millions of people, you know, really impacting on a massive problem, let's face it. And that was always both of our dreams in research, isn't it, to make an impact like that. I mean, how did it feel when you got the results from the trial and you said, oh, God, this is actually working? And then to realise, I don't know how many million people have been vaccinated at this stage, but I'm just trying to get a sense of that.
Yeah, we think it's around about the 50 million mark so far and counting. But, you know, the target is 2 or 3 billion this year, and that's still on. So the short answer, Luke, is it hasn't sunk in because it's been such a crazy ride. And, you know, what I think is a couple of things are really gratifying. The public are really interested in the sort of thing that we like to do, and we've been doing for a while, you know, so we joke that every taxi driver now knows what a phase three trial is and how you should try and do them. It's extraordinary the interest has been in vaccines and the newspaper coverage and everything. So that is fantastic. But also to be able to, in a way, validate the technology that we thought was pretty good and compare it to the best that's out there and see that we can move quickly. And of course, what we'd love to do from now on is move as quickly with other vaccine programs as we've been allowed to do with COVID. That's probably not likely. It'll be back to business as usual in a year's time. But I think things will be a bit quicker and better understood. And, you know, it's all about judging risk. And we're trying to minimize what are already really, really small risks in clinical vaccine development.
Well, exactly. Yeah, no, it's amazing to think, isn't it? As you say, billions from a vaccine that began in the Jenner. I mean, it's a superb thing that really gives an example of how if you stick at something long enough, and it's years and years of effort, let's face it. People think it's an overnight thing sometimes, but it's not.
Yeah, no, that's right. You can't start from nowhere. You have to be prepared. And, you know, it's not just having the technology, it's having the people who've spent years working on this, because every step along the development pathway requires specific expertise, and you can't just recruit that expertise quickly.
Exactly, yeah. And one other thing when I think of it, actually, remember you told me once Bill Gates came to visit, didn't he? He spent a day in your lab.
Did. Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yep.
He went to one of your lab meetings even. Tell us about that.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Bill's amazing. I mean, he has been a cheerleader for vaccines. He has, behind the scenes, been influencing things in terms of you know, identifying what the best approaches are, whether vaccines are going to succeed, whether you need to build huge manufacturing facilities for them. He was going to do that at one stage. It's turned out we've managed without them. And so he's been a great cheerleader for vaccines. On the other hand, of course, he's been a big target for certain groups on social media, yeah, saying he's trying to sterilize the planet and all that nonsense. But yeah. No, he's been an asset.
And I remember you telling me, Aidan, he's very smart, isn't he? Because he was sitting there asking killer questions as well. So he's got it all going on, hasn't he?
He doesn't do a lot of small talk.
No,
he's
that's
right. Right into the detail. And boy, does he know the detail. One of his kind of right-hand men turned up the few days beforehand and gave us a briefing on what he'd like to see. And I said, would we send him some review papers, you know, 4 or 5 pages? Yeah. And he said, not more than, say, 400 pages. I said, you mean 400 pages? He meant 400 pages.
Oh, my God. Isn't that incredible?
And more than that, when he showed up, it was clear he'd read it all.
He'd read them. Yeah, it's refreshing.
Quite extraordinary.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, when you look at the more global picture, Adrian, I mean, obviously COVAX is very important now, right? I believe AstraZeneca have said they're going to make the vaccine available to the developing world. I mean, that's a really important thing, isn't it? Because obviously...
It's more than that. That was, you know, center stage from the very beginning. We have, of course, an Irish vice chancellor here at the University of Oxford, and Louise herself was absolutely adamant that we would not be making money out of this pandemic, that we were going to use the resources of the university. And an extraordinary number of people have been involved in all sorts of activities addressing the pandemic. But, you know, the vaccine was to be sold during the pandemic and beyond in low-income countries for basically cost. And that has interestingly been really important. But boy, has it ruffled feathers in the financial world, because you know, we've had quite a bit of flack from the financial press, and it's not obvious to everyone why they're against the AstraZeneca vaccine at times.
Yeah.
But if you just look at the numbers, as they say, you know, coming in with a $3 a dose vaccine when other people are trying to sell at $20 to $30 a dose introduces complications.
Yeah. Does that trouble you? Right? I mean, that side of it is, as you say, can be a bit unfortunate.
No, it did. I think it did. We got used to it. So, you know, there are people out there. But what really annoyed us was a few weeks ago in you know, France and other parts of Europe, there was genuine misunderstanding, thinking that our vaccine might not be as good as the RNA vaccines. And that was from, you know, misleading media. It's rather gratifying just in this week to see the first head-to-head comparison of, it was the Pfizer vaccine, a very good RNA vaccine, and our own, in deployment in about 4 million people in Scotland.
That's right.
And they just compared the incidence of COVID in largely older adults given one vaccine or the other. The data are very, very clear. Both vaccines work extremely well, and ours looked a bit better. So,
know.
You know, that's the first independent head-to-head. So, you know, I think, you know, one shouldn't be worrying about 5 or 10% difference in efficacy in one trial or another, because the trials, frankly, can't be done identically unless they're designed to be done in that way.
Now, I saw that, and that was very gratifying. I mean, you would have predicted it anyway. The phase two was spectacular anyway, wasn't it? I mean, that's what struck me. And obviously, there was a couple of slips that has to be said, though. And I have to ask you about this, because the way AstraZeneca released some of the information and so on, what were your thoughts in that? Remember the low-dose, high-dose issue, and then the fact that...
Yeah, there was great confusion about what the low-dose, high-dose improved efficacy, 90%, was due to. And, you know, what people won't understand, and I didn't, you know, even the day before, is you get this analysis. It was literally on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
You had the teleconference on Sunday afternoon. The press release is just written that evening, and the whole world knows the following morning. So the first thing is you don't have a lot of time to think about the data.
Yeah.
The second thing was that we actually said we didn't know. You know, it's a tough thing to say when the whole world asks about your vaccine. Why did that group have higher efficacy? And we said we were looking into it.
Yeah.
And that was because we were aware at the time that it might have been the half dose, but that seemed a bit unlikely that it would make it so much better. And of course, the answer we know now is the people who had the half dose had a 3-month interval between the first dose and the second dose. And of course, that's what's recommended all around the world now by WHO, by EMA, MHRA originally, to put in that 3 month interval. So we did learn, you know, we thought that might have been the case, a longer interval being better, but we didn't have the data for several more weeks. Yeah. And then that all came out just around Christmas. So yeah, it was difficult to manage that because every journalist jumped on it and said, why is the half dose work? Was it a mistake? Why are they doing this? And of course, the reality is that it's actually pretty useful, and this is something we learned in a large trial, to have different groups rather than just pick one regimen and bank on that. If we had done that and said everyone gets the second dose at 4 weeks, we wouldn't have discovered how well the first dose works. It's about 75% effective. And we certainly wouldn't have discovered that waiting 3 months for the second dose is the way to go.
Yeah. But again, it struck me as that science in action in a way, isn't it? Nothing unusual necessarily. Just the spotlight is glaring on you, isn't it? You know, which again must have brought certain pressures to bear. I mean, how did you manage that? I mean, you just got on with it.
Yeah, but there were a lot of cooks involved here. For a start, we haven't talked about AstraZeneca, who've been fantastic, actually. You know, they came in 2 weeks in April, a company that before last year was selling one vaccine. So a huge oncology company, you know, very large, but limited experience in developing vaccines, and like most of us, no experience in developing them at breakneck speed. Yeah. And they've risked a huge amount of money. Now, it's worked out for them, but there were real risks taking on an academic group's vaccine in April. And then, amazingly, in May, signing contracts for billions of doses to be produced in 2021. I mean, we saw that as an extraordinary kind of vote of confidence in not just our technology, but in the ability to manufacture it at an incredible scale, saying they could do this when obviously they'd never done it before. Yeah. They'd only been introduced to the technology weeks earlier. But they, you know, trusted our process development team, who've been amazing at the Jenner. You know, it's pretty unusual, as you'll know, for a university to have a team that focuses on manufacturing scale-up and methodologies. And we even have our own little GMP facility. But that worked out. So basically, they kind of trusted us a lot, dived in, and have been amazing. But you know, they had to reassure their shareholders. Yeah. In the same press release that we were kind of saying, look, the results look really interesting and we're going to get more data and just hang on, we'll explain it all soon. But, you know, for the press timeline, that isn't good enough.
No. Yeah. Well, what struck me was at the time, because as you probably know, I've had connections to GSK over the years, they are a vaccine company. So again, we were all wondering, why would you go with AstraZeneca? Because they weren't top of the league by any means, were they? But it sounds as if it was just their drive and commitment. Was that the thing that struck you?
Because I guess there's an easy answer to that. There are only four or five big vaccine companies. AstraZeneca is not one of them, as you say, and GSK very much is.
Yeah.
They had already partnered with Sanofi and decided they were going to use their standard technology, protein and adjuvant, that they're very, very good at. The disappointing thing about that is it kind of takes one major player out if two of them partner. And, you know, it's tough as an academic to find an industrial partner, let alone a big pharma partner, much less in weeks. Pfizer were already in bed with BioNTech. That was hugely successful. And, you know, then you've only got Merck left. And, you know, I think the press has reported that we did talk to Merck for a long, long time and ended up with AstraZeneca. And, you know, we were lucky.
Exactly. Yeah. And I guess the other thing was, just come back to the point, AstraZeneca were committed to letting the vaccine go to the developing world as well, weren't they? That must have been part of the negotiations too, I imagine.
It was more than that. At the first meeting, we said, look, this is the deal. We're looking for a partner who will commit to huge global scale and manufacturing at low cost during the pandemic. We think there's a fair chance, and I'm now pretty sure it's a good chance, unfortunately, that this coronavirus will be around for years to come and be a winter outbreak every year, a bit like flu.
Yeah.
And the deal is, in years to come, when that happens and it's like flu, you'll make hopefully a profit out of that. Are you willing to do that?
Yeah.
And in days they decided. It was fantastic. And really unusual.
It's tremendous. Yeah.
And essentially nobody else has done that. Janssen had been much better than the other companies. They've tried to have a sort of minimal profit approach as well. They're using the same technology, viral vector that we use as well. But, you know, by and large, the other companies have stuck to the traditional model.
Exactly, yeah. One other quick thing before we begin to wrap up. The over 65s issue, do you remember this business? And, oh, look, there weren't enough people on the trial. And that was, that, I guess that was a cautious approach from your side, because, you know, initially you didn't have that many people in that age cohort and so on. Do you think that was a mistake in retrospect? Because obviously it did create a bit of noise in the system, shall we say.
The background to that, and this is one of my take-home messages, you know, when normal order is restored and things calm down, there needs to be an effort to harmonize regulatory approaches to licensing pandemic vaccines. Because one thing AstraZeneca spent a lot of time on was talking, well, companies always talk to regulators, but trying to harmonize sovereign regulators to accept the same data set.
Yeah.
So you have things like, you know, the MHRA saying we want this, the European Medicines Agency wanting something like it, but different, more cases, a lower bound of the confidence interval that's different. And of course, the USA saying, we'll tell you exactly how to do it, and you must do it in America, and then we'll look at your data.
Yeah.
That's why we still haven't got FDA licensure, despite having, you know, amazing effectiveness data in populations. So that lack of harmonization between regulators around the world is something the UN or WHO or somebody needs to look at, because you don't get three cracks at doing the trial in a pandemic. You do one very big trial, and it's got to be right, and all the regulators have to be happy with that. So the issue about older adults is, for many vaccines, if you do up to 65 year olds and have good immunogenicity in older adults, European agencies will license that. Not necessarily true in the US. Yeah. So that's another big difference that we were tripped up on a bit. Yes, of course, we did have older adults. We do have them in the trial, but we recruited them later to be cautious, so that, you know, if they're more vulnerable, they're not going to be the first people to be given a vaccine. We estimated how many we needed. What we didn't really allow for correctly was just how cautious older adults, at least in this country, have been during lockdown. They've behaved so well that very few of them have got COVID in the trial setting, at least the people we recruited. So that's been a bit of an issue. But now, as we talked about earlier, there are, you know, huge numbers of cases from surveillance in Scotland and elsewhere. So it's very, very clear. But it hasn't been clear to the last few weeks how well the vaccine works in older adults. So yeah, we might do that differently a bit next time.
There's still a trial running in the US. Is there any of this 20,000 patient trial? Is that right, in the US?
It's pretty well there, actually. Right. You know, we had this other unfortunate event where there was a routine, you know, pause of a trial for a serious adverse event, and multiple regulators in a week said, look, it's fine, carry on. The FDA took 7 weeks. That was just fortunate, I think.
And the way these things go, isn't it? Were you disappointed, Adrian, that the Irish decided not to allow AstraZeneca into the older population? Because that was the decision that was made, as you may remember.
It wasn't a unique decision, and it was evidence-based. You know, as we just said, we didn't have that much data in older adults, and we've, you know, always been pretty sanguine about that, thinking the data are just around the corner, and a lot of them have appeared now. So hopefully that will be corrected fairly quickly.
No question. And that Scottish data really rams it home, doesn't it? I mean, it's amazing what happened there. And again, we're going to see more and more data, aren't we, emerging?
Yeah, and the US data, as you just said, will be coming out soon, hopefully, as well. A lot of older adults there. But, you know, it depends how much you believe in immunology. And I think you do, Luke.
I do indeed. I believe in it from the start.
if you look at the immune responses in the older adults, and they're the same as the younger adults.
Yeah, exactly.
Likely the vaccine's going to work in both.
Well, that's what struck me. That data from the phase two was spectacular, wasn't it? It was great response. There was no question it was going to work in older people. Sure there wasn't. So I guess it just has to play its way out through the system, I guess, for people to realize how good it is. But you know, the business, and just a couple of more things, the variants now that are cropping up, as we know. What's your opinion of those at the moment? And then in terms of the need for a booster and so on, can you tell us what your feelings are at the way things stand? I know it's a moving target, but at the moment, what's your view?
It is. But at the moment, we've got three common variants that are of concern. The English or Kent variant, as it's sometimes called, we have a lot of data on. The vaccine works not quite as well as against the original variant, but, you know, it's only down non-statistically significantly. So yeah. We can deal with the English variant with the current set of vaccines. So that's very good news. Then there are the South African variant and the Brazilian variant, which are related. They are more difficult for the current vaccines. They are neutralized less well. For South Africa, that's a big issue because that's where that's the strain that's prevalent there at the moment. In Northern Europe, it's still really relatively uncommon. Yep. And happily doesn't appear to be increasing in frequency very quickly. I think it's being outcompeted by the other variants. But, you know, we can make a better vaccine for the South African variant. Yep. Everybody I know who's seriously into this activity is making vaccines against the South African variant. They'll be around by summer, at least in clinical trials. Yep. They should be ready for, you know, next winter. And my guess is, yes, they will be used, probably not everywhere, but certainly in regions where there's a lot of the South African variant. The big question is whether, you know, variants will keep on emerging and we'll end up chasing different ones every year. I think probably not. I think there's more convergent than divergent yeah. evolution going on at the moment. So, you know, a few strains might cover it.
Right. But you would anticipate boosters, wouldn't you? I suppose we all have to just get ready for that. I think even the UK said there would be a booster shot in the autumn. And is the AstraZeneca vaccine good for boosters, do you think? Because you know the way there's the business of the vector and how
No, that's fantastic. That's one of the real bonuses of what we've seen. You know, we've looked very hard for inhibition of booster doses by immunity to the vector, and we're just really not seeing it. And that surprises people a lot. It doesn't surprise us so much. We've been working on these vectors for quite a while. But, you know, we're doing a third administration booster study in the next couple of months. Right. That should really finalize that. So, yeah, very confident that you can reuse these Great. Viral vectors after periods of months.
Great stuff. And whatever way you look at it, I mean, one thing we've been saying here is I've been saying in the media, whatever way you look at it, the vaccines will stop against severe disease anyway. It's more than likely, isn't it? They mightn't stop you getting sniffles, as Fauci famously said, but there's a good chance that the AstraZeneca vaccine, like the others in a sense, will decrease severity, whatever way you look at it. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that the efficacy is higher against severe disease, hospitalization and death, you know, up in the 90% to 100% range, yeah. and lower, you know, in the 70 to 85% range, depending on what regimen you use, against mild disease. But, you know, as some people say to me, you know, mild disease, if you didn't know there was a pandemic, you wouldn't notice. Yeah. And you get the bonus of getting some useful immunity from a mild infection.
Exactly.
So that's not a terrible outcome.
Exactly.
It's the severe disease, hospitalization and death that you really want to control. And all of the vaccines are very good at doing that.
Yeah. We'll finish with the question I'm asked at least four times a day. What does the future look like? give us Adrian Hill's opinion on the next 6, 12, 18 months, if you wouldn't mind. I know it's tricky to look into a crystal ball, but I do think the data is so strong, let's face it. We can now begin to think about the next period, can't we? Where will we be?
As you know, Luke, scientists don't make those decisions on what the future of relieving lockdown is like. And just in the last couple of days, we've heard in both the UK and Ireland plans that are reasonably sensible and cautious and I think appropriate, given that we don't want another lockdown. You know, what I'd like to think is that now we have a timeline laid out in some detail, that we might be even able to do slightly better than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there will be pressure if cases keep going down and, you know, we're down to midsummer levels by late March, say, that we might be able to accelerate that a little bit. Right. I don't know. Nobody knows.
No.
But, you know, I think what's happening at the moment is cautious. If the vaccines continue to be rolled out at the amazing speed that they are, and that's an extraordinary achievement that, you know, we academics have nothing to do with. It's just fantastic to see it happening.
We might be able to do a little bit better and unlock a little faster, right. but I don't know that. But I wouldn't be surprised if it did happen.
Right, and you might imagine a future where there will be vaccinations every winter, probably mainly in the older vulnerable groups, and then possibly in children. And it's just like another infectious disease, right, where there is a vaccines are available, and we can think about that in the future, can't we?
Yeah, I think what you'll have is annual vaccination. You know, in November for the vulnerable groups. Certainly, maybe people over a certain age, over 50s, as they do for flu in America. And, you know, we just don't know after that. It might well be that, you know, in 5 years' time, you're not doing that because the coronavirus has mutated to a sort of common cold-like phenotype.
Exactly.
But, you know, we need to follow this. Some people are doing that.
And it'll be a dim and distant memory. And you may take some time off. Finally, I imagine you're.
And we could do something else for a change. Yes.
Well, do malaria. How about that one? Wouldn't that be brilliant?
Absolutely. We'll focus on that.
Fantastic, Adrian. Thanks ever so much. Thanks for joining.
Cheers.
Me.
Thanks for asking those great questions, Luke. A pleasure as always.
So thank you to Professor Adrian Hill for his time. Very grateful to Adrian. He's obviously a very busy man. And thanks for joining me for this special bonus episode of Show Me the Science. As always, don't forget to subscribe and tell all your friends about the series, and we will see you very soon.